Okay, this is continuing with John Bolton after a intermission of 18 months or so at Parks on 15 March 78. And let me just fill in a few things that we didn't talk about the first few years of radio source work and solo work as far as that goes. First of all, you mentioned to me that you actually started off at 60 megahertz looking for radio sources and had quite a bit of trouble there.
Yes, Bruce Lee and I, late in 1946, built a 60 megahertz, essentially polarization detector for work on the sun. And this was looking at the polarization of solar bursts, switching between left-handed and right-handed mm-hmm. circular polarization. We were interested in seeing if we could split up the general background of galactic radiation, and I guess we did two things wrong. First of all, we worked at the wrong frequency, because 60 megahertz was a tremendous amount of ionospheric scintillation. And the other thing was we conducted a search looking at things like the brightest stars, planetary nebulae, and that kind of thing, from which we could perhaps by analogy with solar radiation, imagine reasons right. why there should be radio emission.
Were these just taken out of Norton Star Atlas or something like that?
That kind of thing, yes. Yeah. We didn't have an astronomical library at that stage of the operation. I guess Russell Duggan Stewart was our Bible.
Oh, yeah.
Second edition.
Second edition. However, you say this was actually for solar work, that this receiver and antenna
yes,
was supposed to
Yes, this receiver was intended to provide experimental data on which D.F. Martin would provide the theoretical background.
I see.
Looking at polarized noise storms.
That's right, he had actually predicted some polarization
yes,
in the quiet component, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the quiet component
yes,
of the sun.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But were you sort of sneaking this in on the side, on the slide?
Yes, we were sneaking right. this thing in on the side. In fact, Pawsey came and found us doing it and promptly decided that we should go back into radio physics and not continue any work at Dover Heights. And I went to work with Gordon Stanley on building similar polarization equipment for an eclipse expedition, which Pawsey was going to take to Brazil.
For the May 47
yes,
eclipse, I believe it was.
And that expedition never took place, and when they missed the last boat, Pawsey came into the lab where Stanley and I were making this equipment, and he said to me, it looks as though we're not going to Brazil. If you can think of anything to do with this equipment, you can have it. And as he went out of the room, he said, if you can think of anything to do with Gordon Stanley, you can have him too. And so we began again. We took this equipment all out to Dover Heights, set ourselves up a solar observatory.
Now at 200?
We had 200, 100, 85 and 60 megahertz equipment. And we actually observed the first of the Type 2 solar outbursts, I think in March of 47.
Now, why were you still working on the sun? I thought you had another green light.
Well, this was solar equipment, and we set it up to work on the sun, and in the February of 47, when we got out there, it looked as though it might be a very exciting period on the sun, because there was a big sunspot group developing. And as a matter of fact, we saw it disappear from one edge of the sun, reappear on the other edge,
mm-hmm.
and we were getting absolutely nothing from it until it was almost on the meridian. And then one Saturday afternoon, I went back to Dover Heights and turned the antennas onto the sun, and within 5 minutes, we got the biggest signal we'd ever seen. Blew the 200 megahertz recorder off scale, and the recorders were only running at very slow speed. And I switched the 160 on to high speed on the recorder, turned down the gain.
I see.
And we recorded about 2 minutes later, the 100 megahertz went off scale, and then 3 minutes later, the 60 megahertz. Now, we couldn't accurately time the 200 megahertz, but C.W. Allen at Mount Stromlo had a 200 megahertz patrol equipment which Radio Physics had built, and we got the timing of the outburst to 200 from him. And Ruby Payne Scott and Don Yamsley had been working on the other types of bursts. We put all our data together in one letter to Nature.
Right, which came out in 47.
Yes, well, we followed that sunspot through March and April after the big outburst. We then got a noise storm at very high level. We got some quite interesting polarization work. But at the end of, by mid-May, the solar activity had gone down to nothing. And Stanley had been working on trying to improve the sensitivity and stability of receivers, and we started working the Cliff interferometer again, looking for objects, looking for sea interference patterns, and the earlier failure which Bruce Lee and I had, the wrong frequency and looking for the wrong object, we just started a purely empirical search.
Just a blind...
Just a blind search, and...
But now, actually, when you did that first search, had you gotten word of Hayes' discrete source? Well, I can check when that... Well, you might have had a preprint, though, that's true. It was published in 46, but I don't remember more exactly than that.
Whilst Lee and I were out at... Dover Heights, that work did appear, and in fact after we came back to Radio Physics, Pawsey went out and used some 60 megahertz equipment to look at for the Cygnus scintillations.
I see.
But didn't find them.
Sorry, you mentioned that, I think, actually.
Yes.
And in retrospect, it's probably just because the ionosphere was quiet.
That's right.
When he had to go out.
Yes.
Yeah. So, at that time, then, it was sort of in the middle of your search that you found out about Hayes' sources, as far as you can remember.
As far as I remember...
Well, that would make sense. I mean,
Slee and I had started work, and we had been thrown off it. When Hayes' work was published, Pawsey came out. Pawsey went out himself to Dover Heights with 60 megahertz equipment to look at it and couldn't find it. And so when Stanley and I started up again, locally Hayes' work was not...
Was in disrepute to...
Well, yes. It was,
right.
We certainly didn't take any notice of it.
You mentioned that your interest was not really in the sun, and yet when the sun was active, you seemed to have been quite enthusiastic about working with it for a couple of months. Was it just that the quiet sun bored you, but when it was active, that seemed to be sort of the...
Well, at that stage, of course, we couldn't see the quiet sun. There wasn't a... The Cliff interferometer, of course, resolved the quiet sun out.
Yes, that's true, that's right.
Stanley and I did, in fact, find the quiet sun at low frequencies eventually.
It had been recognized, of course, from Pawsey's correlation with sunspot number and so forth. But it wasn't something that was easy to study.
See, you were at sunspot maximum, so it was dominated by...
But anyway, it seems that your real interest was in the radio sources, and so you began a blind search, which I guess simply means starting at a slightly different azimuth each morning and seeing what you found. And we covered this before, and you said that I believe Taurus was the first, and Centaurus was also in there, but you didn't recognize it at the time.
Well, it's hard to say. Before we found Cygnus source, we had a possible detection of Centaurus at 200 megahertz. This would have been in May of 47. But unfortunately, our 200 megahertz equipment blew up.
Why was that?
we had problems with the antenna and wind and so on, and the antenna got badly damaged, so we concentrated on 100 megahertz. So probably historically, Centaurus was the first one first object we found, followed by Cygnus. But in the literature, we give Cygnus as the first one, and the Crab Nebula as the second one.
Yeah, I'm looking at the 48.
But this was the order in which they were discovered at 100 megahertz, but we'd probably seen Centaurus at 200 megahertz before, in fact, Cygnus.
I see. Yeah, I'm looking at the 1948 Nature article, and indeed the only 46 source is Cygnus, and the other major ones are all 47. Mm. Now, let me just ask a couple clearing up points about things we discussed before, namely the fact that the refraction corrections that you were using were incorrect, led to large errors in the positions you gave in this 1948 article.
Yes.
And however, the refraction corrections were not as large as 5 or 10 degrees. The errors in the corrections were not that large.
Oh, no.
Can you just tell me how this, why this became magnified?
Well, the CN interferometer pattern one interprets as the apparent position of an object at subsequent fringe minima. So what one gets a curve of is the apparent zenith angle versus time,
right,
which is related to the declination. But it's a very insensitive function. So if the slope is just a little wrong, a difference of refraction correction of, say, 20 minutes of arc between 0 and 10 degrees makes a declination error, which... well, actually, I think you determine the cosine of the declination, so that if you have a declination near zero, it's a very large error. I think you'll find that our error in the case of Cygnus was only of the order of a degree, but our error in the case of M87, which is at 12 degrees, was the order of 10 degrees.
It turns out to be worse for something near the equator.
That's right.
I think something that's rising perpendicular.
Ah, yes.
I would think that would be...
But it's a cosine...
Ah,
it's a cosine declination term, which is insensitive near zero.
Okay. And the reason that this incorrect correction came about was because of the lack of recognition that radio bursts do not coincide necessarily with the active...
Yes, it so happened in Paus's original experiments, the spots at which he'd observed were generally on one limb of the sun, and so the correction... The error was always in the same sense.
And you said that Peirce's theory was based on this observation.
Yes, Peirce's theory indeed fitted the Paus's observation, but the Peirce's theory was based on the smooth ionosphere.
Right.
And
did he twiddle his parameters in order to get it to fit the Paus's observation? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, it was an order of magnitude calculation. I mean, the actual densities and electron distribution in the ionosphere was not very well known.
Then. Yeah, okay.
I think numbers could be adjusted to fit the Paus's observation.
Right.
There was a lot of scatter on the Paus's observation, of course, so, I mean, it was...
But now, if you hadn't had that theory, then what would you have used for the refraction? In any case,
I guess if we hadn't had that theory, we would have used optical refraction, not knowing any better.
Yeah. Okay.
We found, of course, immediately we went to New Zealand when we did observations of the East Coast rising, there was discrepancies immediately came up. In fact, we had some azimuth resolution in our antennas that we took to New Zealand, and
they were larger.
Yes, they were larger. The observations we made in the initial Sydney observations only had the resolution of a single yagi, so that we had several yagis on New Zealand experiments. And of course, when it came to West Coast observations, the first observations I think we did of the Crab Nebula, the object had set.
You couldn't find it at all.
We'd even started.
Was that clear? Well, you must have first thought that something wasn't working in the equipment.
Well, I think our first indication of the things that were horribly wrong Was the observation of Cygnus, which we had hoped to see through transit and down the other side.
Right.
And our declination for Cygnus, I think, was 1 or 2 degrees further north.
That's right, 1 degree.
Yes. Yeah. And, of course, the interference pattern just went on and went on. The lobes were getting longer and longer, but they weren't stopping as they should have done if the Cygnus declination had been 43 degrees and not 41.5 degrees.
I see. So then you said, well, maybe all these other sources are off, too.
Yes. Yes, I think it became clear to us on the East Coast that we had some moderate errors in our initial positions, but as soon as we went to the West Coast, we realized there were dramatic errors.
Well, it seems a little curious to me that you took along a larger antenna on this more or less expedition to New Zealand than you had at home on your home field site.
Well, we got some funds to build this second, in the Sydney experiments, we used two Yagis, one on top of each other, so that it narrowed our vertical pattern and not horizontal pattern. In New Zealand experiment, we took six Yagis, two vertical and three horizontal, which we later cut down to four, because the spacing, we'd got them a little close together initially. And,
did you then bring that back and use that?
Well, the reason for building a new set of equipment was that we wanted to find out whether the scintillations of the sources were genuine or not from a spaced antenna experiment. So Bruce Slee, who in the meantime had rejoined the group, operated the Sydney equipment and we operated the New Zealand equipment. We actually did some solar observations to see whether solar bursts correlated.
I see.
And as they did, and the radio source scintillations did not. This was the proof that the scintillations were, in fact, scintillations and not inherent in the source.
And this work was done in 48?
48, yes.
Right. Now, usually in the accepted wisdom, credit is given to Little and Lovell and Smith, a couple of papers in Nature in 50, for finally establishing that the scintillations were ionospheric. However, this work was done before, but published much later, I believe.
It was done before, and the Cambridge group were well aware of our results. In fact, I had suggested that Ryle did the experiment.
Just as a confirmation, you mean?
Well, we had spaced antennas 1,500 miles apart. It was very difficult for us to get spaced antennas, certainly using the sea interferometer, with a realistically smaller spacing, because the coast of New South Wales runs in such a direction that for every 100 miles you go north, you only get 1 mile or a few miles of effective spacing between the antenna. So it was clearly not an experiment for us, whereas Jodrell Bank and Manchester could easily... And they had much bigger antennas than we had. I mean, both Lovell and Ryle's arrays were at least two orders of magnitude better than ours, so they had no problem with signals.
I see what you're saying. So,
and in fact, in the paper by Little and Lovell and Ryle and Smith, you will find that it says information from Pawsey.
That's right. That is there. That's true. So the idea was that you had established that there was no long baseline correlation, but there still might be something on a 50-100 kilometer sort of...
Well, no. I mean, the experiment we suggested was to find the scale of the...
Of the correlation.
Yes.
At some point it must correlate. Yeah.
Yes, at some point it must correlate. Yeah. And it was one of those very unfortunate things of history that I kept writing to Ryle and saying, how is it going? And he didn't let me know the experiment was being done, and he didn't even let Lovell know that I'd suggested that. In fact, at the 1950 meeting in Ursi in Zurich, Lovell made a public apology.
Was that was that 50 in Zurich? Which meeting was that? I'm not familiar.
This was Ursi in Zurich.
And only 2 years later it was in Sydney in 52?
Yes, the associate at that time was every 2 years.
I see.
In fact, they didn't change over the 3 years, I think, until 1960.
So you were not in correspondence then with John Will Bank at this time?
No. No, my first... I actually went to England in 1950, and the first thing that greeted me in the scientific liaison office in Australia House was the nature of the...
I see.
The article in, so relations at Cambridge were very strange.
Which was going to take another couple of months to get to Australia, yeah. Well, perhaps we should break for some... Okay, just looking at the first few papers on radio sources, which you published, it seemed to me that the idea that you had as to the origin of these radio sources was that it was the integrated effect of millions of these that was making up the galactic background. Mm. It just happens to be that these were the strongest in the, what we would now say the luminosity function. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that was the initial approach, and certainly the identification of the crab supported this, though the two galaxies we got obviously made us wonder. And, I think...
Well, one you were not quite willing to believe was a galaxy because you found...
Well, there was no evidence that it was at the time, in fact.
Well, but even for M87, you say that it's never been resolved into stars, so you're really being devil's advocate there.
Yes.
Sounds like
one of the interesting things was on this, when we got these first three identifications, the crab was a very likely...
Oh, yeah, right. That's pretty...
The others were somewhat lucky in that they were relatively nearby, as they'd been a lot further away, because we'd never have got them, and we didn't, in fact, get the signals with the accuracy. With